Welcome back. We're about to start the third hour of Ira David Wood III's Confessions of an Elf.
The Lost Children. Grief fills the room up of my absent child. William Shakespeare. The boss and his wife live in the Great Lodge at the North Pole. This place is every wonderful thing your imagination could possibly make it, and more. It sits at the center of the entire complex of lodges and buildings. Some people have always imagined that the toy shop is at the center of things, but it never was. It's neither the center geographically or ideologically, and I believe there's a fundamental lesson in this design. The boss's family comes first, above anything. Everything he thinks, says, or does has family at the center of it. It's just the way he is, and I guess that makes us elves very lucky. We're part of his family, and we share in everything. The good times, which are frequent, and the not-so-good times, which are infrequent but inevitable, even for Santa Claus. Now, you might imagine that the boss hits the floor every morning with Christmas on his mind. In a way, he does, but I'll explain that later. You might think he can hardly wait to get to the toy shop each day. You might even imagine the amount of time he spends poring over that infamous book of names. Who's been naughty or nice, that sort of thing. Nothing could be further from the truth. Santa Claus begins a normal day very quietly. He takes his time in the morning, even when he is excited about getting to work. He uses this very special and private time to center himself, to take stock and plan the rest of his day in his mind. It doesn't take him very long at all, and the routine varies from time to time. Sometimes he'll put on some music while he dresses. Sometimes he'll dress, then sit quietly in his favorite chair for a few minutes, gazing silently out of the window. There are times he'll go for a quiet morning walk, all by himself. I know for a fact that he talks to God during these morning private times. Some people might describe it as praying, and I guess you could say that. But honestly, it's more like a private talk, a conversation. Sometimes God talks and Santa listens. Sometimes Santa talks and God listens. I know they both laugh together a great deal of the time. It's often been said that God has a terrific sense of humor. Most people just don't think of a God in quite that way. Would anyone without a sense of humor have made an armadillo or a duck-billed platypus? Think about it. He places his family next on the list. When he's finished with his private morning time, he comes into the dining hall and joins everyone else. And because he's cared enough to take his private time each day, when he does enter the dining hall, he's already radiating with something extra special. Most people will tell you that Santa Claus lights up a room when he enters. Well, this is why. Do you know what working a room means? Well, he's a master at it. His focus, his complete attention is immediately on everyone else. And it's uncanny, but he always seems to know when someone needs an extra pat on the shoulder, a hug, a kind word, or even a gentle reprimand. This may shock you, but elves aren't perfect either. Mrs. Claus is there with his usual mug of hot spiced tea. He always gives her a kiss on the cheek when she hands it to him. The tea is always served with a loving smile. And let me tell you that this is routine, but not an empty routine. What they share, even the little times, is never taken for granted. They just don't do it unless they mean it. The beauty of their relationship is that, for the greater portion of the time, they do mean it, and it shows. It's that important to both of them. What you might call an investment. By the way, did you know that the rest of the world didn't even realize there was a Mrs. Claus until a woman wrote about her for the first time in 1899? True. The writer's name was Catherine Lee Bates, and the title of her work was Goody Santa Claus on a Sleigh Ride. Catchy, huh? Still, we were all genuinely happy for Mrs. Claus because it was time she began receiving the public acclaim she was rightfully due. By the way, Catherine Lee Bates wrote 32 books. Most of them are long forgotten now. But don't feel too bad. She managed to write one very lovely song, America the Beautiful. They're a great team, the boss and his wife. They've taken the time and the work it takes to become secure with each other. They know instinctively what the other needs, and they're there to supply it. Don't get me wrong, I don't think they always had it. In fact, I happen to know that it wasn't always smooth sailing, and they still don't always agree with each other. But I also know that the light in their bedroom doesn't go out until they do, or at least until they honestly accept their agreement to have the freedom to sometimes disagree. And they're very clear on the fact that disagreement doesn't mean rejection. It only moves into that realm when you don't take the time to communicate. And brother, that's something they do on a daily basis. Someone once said that work is only something you don't want to do. But I happen to know that they honestly but joyously work at their relationship and are wise enough to know it takes a very little time every day. And sometimes I know it doesn't come easily for either of them. Can you imagine what sort of pressure the boss and his wife constantly live with? We're talking Santa Claus here. Now, I know you've heard the phrase about living in a fishbowl. At 5 o'clock every day, the boss and his wife have their private time together. They go into the study and sit together on a large sofa in front of a great stone fireplace and visit. Sometimes they don't do anything but hold hands, letting the time pass in silence. I've even seen them share an occasional glass of sherry. But what makes those silences different from other times is the love contained at the center of it all. And because of this invested time together, they've always managed to keep a great deal of passion in their relationship. This is a pretty sizable accomplishment. Let's face it, they aren't spring chickens anymore. The courtship seems to keep going. It's kept them young, it's kept them strong, it's kept them together. The boss and Mrs. Claus know that happiness is a decision. They mutually arrived at this long-term resolution ages ago. In retrospect, their decision was a very wise one. It has kept them together for ages in joyous unison and quiet contentment. There is a small, single room in a far wing of the Great Lodge that's officially off-limits to everyone but the boss himself. Of all the other rooms in the entire lodge, this one, given its location, is separated from the rest of the cheerful noise and bustle that always seemed to fill the others. It's a place he rarely visits. It wasn't until some careful but distant observation that we finally realized he would usually go off this room just after some major, unpleasant world event had taken place. For many, many years, no one even knew what was in this room. It was Santa Claus's private place, and that was enough for us. We have great respect for the boss's desire for some occasional privacy, and never once asked him about it. Of course, we were curious. Elves are, by nature, very curious creatures. But since the boss never talked about the room to anyone, we always managed to keep our insatiable curiosity to ourselves. After all, when you're as much of a public figure as Santa Claus, you certainly deserve at least one quiet corner of the world where you can go to simply get away from things. One day, we had a sort of mini-emergency in the toy shop. It was nothing major, just a question of a deadline that had to be moved up. Still, all schedule changes have to be cleared by the boss himself. Now, if elves are curious creatures, we're also sticklers for proper procedure. So, since I had the piece of paper in my hand at the time, I told the others that I would find the boss and get his okay on it. The first place I looked was the study. He wasn't there. I couldn't find him in the great room or even in the reindeer station. For a moment or two, I considered the fact that he might have gone out for one of his walks. But he never took a walk during this particular time of the day, so I hesitated to bundle up and go out to look for him. I stood in the hallway, paper in hand, trying to figure out where he might have gone. Then it occurred to me to go to the closed door of that little faraway room and knock. That's where he was. It took a few moments before he answered, and when he did, his voice was soft and distant. "Who is it?" he asked. I cleared my throat and squared my shoulders. No one had ever intruded on his privacy in this room before. I was the first elf to do it, and I was very much aware of the fact. "We've had a last-minute switch and a deadline," I said, speaking to the door. "We just need your okay on it." Then, almost as a second thought, I added, "I'll be happy to come back later if you'd like." "No, no," I heard him softly reply. "I'll take a look at it now. Come in." Well, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I had just been invited into a room no one had ever visited but the boss himself. This is something that happens very rarely, if at all, to anyone in the world. I had no idea what to expect. I hardly even knew how to react. Still, when the boss says come in, you do. Slowly and as quietly as possible, I turned the knob and eased the door open only wide enough to put my head in. The room was dark. There were several lights on, but the room was still a dark place. Have you ever noticed that different rooms in your own homes have different moods? A dining room has a mood that's quite different from, say, a playroom. Well, this was very true here. It was as much the mood of the room that contributed to the feeling of darkness as it was the number of lights burning within it. And the mood of that room was undeniably dark. The walls were mahogany, dark mahogany. There were several tables with lamps on them. But that was it. There was no other furniture in the entire room, nothing else except for a single large easy chair in the center of everything, right in the middle of the room. It was made of leather, dark leather, and the whole chair swiveled on its base so it could face any direction. This was where the boss was sitting when my eyes grew accustomed enough to locate him there. "It's all right," he said softly. "Come on in." Still, he never looked at me directly. His gaze was somewhere else, someplace distant, even beyond the walls of the room. Instinctively, I followed the direction of his gaze with my own eyes, just in case he happened to be in the room with someone else. And that's when I saw them. The pictures and photographs, there were hundreds of them, and they were everywhere. It's difficult for me to describe it, the sheer amount of them, lining the walls, sitting in antique frames on the two tables, some of them simply leaning against the walls along the perimeter of the room. Pictures and photographs of children. A few of them were so old that they were yellowed with age, and the edges of the paper were ragged and torn. It was immediately obvious that the boss had taken great care to preserve all of them, but particularly the older ones. They had all been lovingly matted and framed behind glass. Some of the frames were priceless antique things with golden gilt trim. Other frames were more modern in appearance. The older ones weren't photographs, but paintings or etchings. Some were nothing but black cut-out silhouettes. Some were done with oil paint. Some in watercolor. Some of the photographs were black and white, and others were in full color. They were all sizes and shapes, but they were all pictures or photographs of children. It was enough to take your breath away, and it did. I was unable to speak for a few minutes. To cover my awkward silence, I stepped into the room and quietly closed the door behind me. Once inside, I simply stood there, glancing around the room, looking into the faces of children who returned my gaze from picture frames, numbering virtually in the hundreds. Suddenly, the boss sighed and shifted slightly in the great chair. He was bringing himself back from some place far beyond. Slowly, he stretched out his hand toward me. "Let's see the schedule change," he said. His request snapped me back into reality. I walked briskly to his chair and handed him the slip of paper. He scanned it briefly, and after another moment of quiet consideration, nodded in agreement. "We can do this," he nodded. I handed him a pen, and he scribbled his initials, S.C., at the bottom of the paper, then handed it back to me. I hesitated for a second more, in case he had anything to add to the instructions, but he just sighed again and settled back in the great chair, returning his gaze to that place beyond the walls of the room. Realizing that my official reason for staying there had passed, I turned and headed toward the door. "Never expected anything like this, did you?" the boss asked as I reached for the doorknob. I froze. I didn't want him to think that I had been prying. I had hoped he hadn't noticed my reaction to the pictures and photographs, even though he would have had to have been blind not to. Oh, what do I say now? I asked myself in that brief moment of desperation. What else? Came the silent answer from my heart. The truth. I turned around to face him again. I'm sorry, I stammered with some difficulty. I didn't want to bother you. The boss swiveled the great chair around so that he was facing me. And for the first time in my life, I saw sadness in his eyes. I've seen him tired before. I've even seen him depressed and nervous. But I've never, ever seen him sad. And my heart came right up into my throat. Tell me what you see in this room, the boss said. I swallowed hard, trying desperately to force my heart down and out of my voice. Hundreds of children, I replied hoarsely. Pick one, he said. I don't understand what you mean, I answered. Pick a single face, a single pair of eyes, he explained quietly. I took several steps toward the center of the room again and glanced around. I was still feeling awkward and hadn't yet recovered from the effect of finding so much sadness in the boss's eyes. So I just took a deep breath and pointed to one of the framed pictures. It wasn't that I would have necessarily picked that particular picture. It was just that I wanted to do something that would buy me a little more time to adjust. From his place in that great chair, the boss studied the picture I had chosen. Finally, he nodded slightly, and still gazing at the picture, he started to speak. That is the picture of a boy who lived in England in the 1600s. His mother and father were very poor. They worked every day from sunrise to sunset in order to simply survive. I think they truly loved the boy, but they never showed him any affection. I suppose they thought it was enough just to keep him alive. He wanted very badly to earn their love. Some small, simple show of affection. A touch, a hug now and then. One day before the sun had even come up, that little boy took a small sack of seeds from his father's coat pocket and planted them in the family's little garden, located just behind their ramshackle house. He took the seeds without asking, of course, but he only did it because he thought he was helping his parents in some small way. When his father got up and discovered that the seeds had been taken and planted without his knowledge, he went into a rage. He beat that boy into unconsciousness and finally left him broken and bleeding on the back doorstep of the house. The boy was only 7 years old, and that beating changed his life forever. The boss paused in his story and cleared his throat. I could see tears in his eyes. "Do you know who the Comprachicos were?" he asked. "No, I don't," I replied. "In 17th century Europe," he went on, "there were wandering bands of smugglers. They were called Comprachicos. Their stock in trade was buying children, deforming them, and then selling them to the aristocracy. The practice was permitted because the aristocracy thought it was fashionable to have freaks in court." "Freaks!" I repeated out loud. The boss nodded and sighed heavily. "The Comprachicos practiced certain arts," he explained in slow, labored words. "These arts included stunting children's growth, placing muzzles on their faces to deform them, slitting their eyes, dislocating their joints, and malforming their bones." The boss lapsed into complete silence. The reason was obvious. Tears were streaming down his face, lining his white beard with the wet traces of his absolute sadness. "And this little boy in the picture," I began, fumbling for words, "he was one of their victims?"
"In a way," the boss replied.
"You could say he was a victim, but not of the Comprachicos. You see, some years later, he became the first Comprachico. He's the one who actually began all of the horror that followed. It's all there, if you look closely enough at his picture on the wall, in his face and eyes. The hurt and pain of a 7-year-old boy. Pain that grew and malformed like that bag of stolen seeds he planted to win his father's love." The sheer force of the story staggered me backward several steps. I actually held out my hands to try to regain my balance. My head swirled with overlapping visions of deformed children. My ears filled immediately with the cries and screams of victims of such terrible cruelty. It was a horrible moment, and one that I will remember for the rest of my life. All of us, with ever-growing frequency, are routinely made aware of the terrors in this world. You can't check out of a supermarket without seeing the face of still another victim plastered across the pages of some tabloid newspaper. Freaks are still entertaining. People still fight and kill each other, and we are aware of it. There are still wars and famine and disease, and we are aware of it all. It is an inescapable reality, a reminder of how far the world has yet to go until all of humanity is able to stand side by side in the light of the sun. But it's not until you are made to focus all the pain, hurt, and suffering into the shape of a single child. It's only then that it takes a comprehensible form. We can be aware of the fact that 6 million Jews lost their lives in the death camps of a terrible war, men, women, and children. But we can't come close to comprehending any of it until we can look into the eyes of just one of the victims, eyes that stare mournfully back at you from a faded photograph world. The boss's soft voice brought me back from the vivid ghosts of my own imaginings. "I call this place the Room of Lost Children," he said. "My children. Children who might have grown up to be blessed in the world. Children who could have made such a wonderful difference." The boss, with great effort, stood slowly in the center of the room. "Somewhere along the way, I lost these," he said, pointing toward the picture-covered walls. "Or they lost me. They lost the spirit of what I represent. So I keep their pictures here, in this little room, and add to them. Once here, they never leave." The boss moved slowly in one large circle, occasionally pointing out a single picture or photograph, as he called out their names in a solemn roll call. Some of the names would have been familiar to anyone. Booth, Capone, Eichmann, Speck, Judas, Gacy, Manson. But these were not the faces of murderers. They were children, not the now familiar adults seen on newsreels or later in photographs. The incredible thing to me was that so many of the faces were of smiling, happy children, faces that did not contain a single hint or glimmer of the terrible things that would eventually take the light of the world from each pair of eyes. Now I knew the real reason the room seemed so terribly dark. It wasn't that it was merely filled with darkness. It was haunted by it. "Sometimes," the boss said, placing a hand on my shoulder, "I come here to remind myself of a few things. I mourn the loss of these children, but I also reaffirm, again and again, how important it is to save the ones who are still just on the brink. Maybe it would have made a more cheerful place to have displaced the pictures of the saved ones. but I just didn't think that was strong enough. I never want to stop trying as hard as I can. As sad a reminder as this room is, it's what keeps me going. We both paused to take a last gaze of those silent walls, walls that cried out in anguish and despair, walls that echoed with a single, united plea from the souls of all lost children everywhere. Then the boss flipped the light switch and everything was swallowed by even deeper darkness. We walked out of the room together and closed the door behind us. I've never been back. I don't need to. If I never knew why we do what we can to make this world a better place, I know now, and I'm going to make a difference. It's taken a bit of time, but I've managed a great deal of study regarding human beings. One thing I've learned is that you like to refer to your species as the human race. Not a stroll, mind you, or a walk. Not even an amble. The word you've chosen is race. Well, pardon this elf for saying so, but that sounds as though life might be a bit hurried for you humans. And by its definition, a race generally consists of winners and losers, in which case who are some of the losers in your human race? A survey I read by your Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences estimates that up to 17 to 20% of all children have emotional problems, including depression, anxiety disorders, attention deficit disorders, and psychosis. A much larger number suffer from what is known as adjustment disorders, responses to specific crises in their lives. If we don't begin the healing process in time, these problems are carried over into their adolescent years. The Carnegie Corporation recently completed a study on America's adolescents. The results surprised everyone but those of us closest to Santa Claus. We've known for a long time. The study found that American adolescents spend an average of 5 minutes a day alone with their fathers and 20 minutes of such time with their mothers. On average, teenagers watch about 21 hours of television each week, compared to 5.6 hours spent on homework and only 1.8 hours reading for pleasure. The time that is spent with their families is generally devoted merely to meals or to watching television. Another study tells us that nearly 38% of eighth graders are home alone after school for 2 or more hours. Low-income students are most likely to be home alone for more than 3 hours. While adolescents devote most of their waking hours to the basics, such as school, homework, eating, chores, or paid employment, about 40% of their time, or 5 hours a day, is discretionary. Finally, this same report sadly estimates that half of America's 20 million adolescents, ages 10 to 15, are in danger of never reaching their full potential, in large part because of the opportunities they face for destructive activities in their free time. Their tendency toward violence is becoming alarming. Your National Education Association estimates that every day, 100,000 students carry a gun into their classrooms. Another study reports that 13% of all incidents involving guns in the schools are actually occurring in your elementary and preschools. Every single school day, 6,250 of your teachers are threatened with injury, and 260 are actually assaulted. That's 73,000 teachers assaulted per school year by their students. These are your young people, most of them barely a few steps away from their childhoods, and you are being told that they are in danger. Not just in trouble, mind you, danger. Who are your young people if not a living, breathing reflection of the values you have instilled in them? Who are your young people if not your greatest investment in the future of mankind? Who are your young people if not the truest, most personal motivation for the changes that must be made in this world? Who are your young people that you should deny them the right to grow strong and keen in mind and body? Who are your young people that you should withhold from them the greatest single gift you could possibly ever give? Your time and interest. Right now, I don't believe they feel they even have your undivided attention. I saw the consequences of the apathy of past generations mirrored in the eyes of children peering at me from the pictures and photographs in that solitary room of the Great Lodge. That is why I know what I have to do. If only one photograph is kept from the walls in the room of lost children because of something I said or did, my life will have mattered. And one more child will be able to keep forever the light of hope in his eyes.
Christmas morning. Backward, turn backward, O time, in your flight. Make me a child again, just for tonight. Elizabeth Akers Allen. That's right, mourning. It's a very, very real part of the holiday season. Not many people realize that, but it's very true. Sure, you've all heard of the post-Christmas syndrome. It's how the professionals refer to that psychological letdown that starts to hit you on Christmas Day afternoon. It usually sets in about the time you take a moment's pause to gaze at the mountains of shredded wrapping paper, crumpled boxes, and ribbon scattered around your living room. It's that little, gnawing feeling that creeps into your soul when you amble into the kitchen for a late Christmas Day snack, only to find there's not a clean glass or dish in the entire house. It's peas on earth. Turkey bones and untouched cranberries are everywhere. Pots, pans, and dishes stacked to the ceiling blot out the light. On top of that, the Christmas tree is shedding needles like crazy, drying up before your unbelieving gaze. Depressing. You don't really want to watch TV either, because they're just going to be running It's a Wonderful Life, a tearjerker if Frank Capra ever made one. And who in their right mind needs to spend a single minute of their Christmas holiday crying? And the answer is, almost every Biggle in the world. This is probably one of the unique secrets about Christmas. It's secret because hardly anyone admits to feeling less than wonderful during the Christmas holidays, except for what's normally allowed. Being tired and rushed is always allowed. Everyone can complain about that, and does. So long, of course, as it's that sort of good-natured exasperation that everybody else seems to be going through, too. Sharing complaints of that nature is expected, and relatively harmless in the long run. Besides, procrastination is a very human trait. Given a choice, most people put off things until they absolutely have to do them. Like Christmas shopping. If that weren't a fact of life, shopping malls would be veritable ghost towns on Christmas Eve, and everyone would be home, savoring the simple joys of one of the most special evenings of the year. Now, to really understand what happens to a Biggle during the holidays, you have to accept, first of all, an axiom. It is simply this. All things are created twice. This simply means that your impressions of Christmas have two dimensions. The first dimension is the actual occurrence. It might be one particular Christmas family gathering, or a certain toy you received while you were little. The second dimension becomes your memory of the actual occurrence, how you remember that particular family gathering, or that favorite toy. So the actual event is the first dimension, and your memory of that event becomes the second dimension, and in many ways, the most lasting and more important. Because what actually happened on a particular Christmas past doesn't matter half as much as how you remember it. Human memory is such an amazing thing. An elf's memory works almost exactly the same, only sharper. You can take a moment from life and keep it forever in your heart. It comes back to you the second you recall it. Sometimes, even when you don't consciously choose to do so. Memories roll back into your conscious thoughts like waves from the great ocean of experience. And, like waves, that motion is continuous and rhythmic. Your memories also bring back a great many emotional connections that affect the way you live in and deal with the present. Once, I ate some shrimp that had gone bad. We don't get a lot of shrimp at the North Pole, so they're really a delicacy to elves. The bad shrimp made me ill. For years afterward, all I had to do was smell a bowl of steamed shrimp, and I began to feel nauseated. The memory actually affected me physically, and as much as I had always enjoyed shrimp, all I could do after that single bad experience was sit in the Great Lodge, watching all of the other elves happily pig out on what would have been my share of shrimp. One bowl of bad shrimp, one vivid memory recalled, and it made me physically ill. That's how powerful memory can be. It's true of elves as well as people. Your human brain is like a giant butterfly net, and particular moments are the beautiful, sometimes elusive butterflies. By the time you become a Biggle, you've managed to amass quite a collection. If one bowl of bad shrimp can make an elf physically ill years after the actual moment, imagine what a memory of a particular Christmas can do. It can affect the way you react to each succeeding Christmas for years to come. If your memories are warm and wonderful, it stands to reason that your succeeding Christmas holidays will have a better chance of being so too. If, for reasons you sustain a Christmas hurt or disappointment, then the way your soul and body react to an approaching holiday is directly related to the memory of that experience. Memories can become like tinted lenses through which we view the entire scope of the present. But here's something else to consider, even about those warm and wonderful memories. Generally, whenever Biggles think about Christmas, they tend to think about Christmas's past. In doing so, they often include memories of loved ones with whom they shared those past Christmases. Often and sadly, those loved ones we choose to remember, grandmothers, grandfathers, mothers, fathers, are no longer in the world. So even warm and wonderful memories of Christmas's past can be, and usually are, tinged with a bittersweet quality, something we often find hard to define or even understand. But a certain degree of sadness is as much a part of Christmas as mistletoe and firelight. Missing loved ones who are no longer with us is a natural and inevitable part of all our holiday celebrations, but particularly at Christmas time. Biggles also tend to miss their youth during this time of year. As I explained earlier, Christmas is a time when that little inside of us would like very much to come out and play. That little in us all is only a breath away from our consciousness during Christmas. The wonderful smells of a fresh fir tree, cinnamon tea brewing on a stove, peppermint candy, or a turkey roasting in the oven of a warm, cheery kitchen can, like the Starship Enterprise hitting warp overdrive, hurl you back to the days of your youth with the dizzying speed of light. In your mind's eye, you are suddenly standing in the kitchen you remember when you were young. You can see, actually see, your mother as you choose to remember her when she too was younger, preparing the Christmas turkey or those wonderful holiday cookies. And the exquisite pain of that single incredible moment, the instant that wave of memory crashes to shore with such amazing emotional force, can literally take your breath away. Have you ever seen Biggles do that? Ever seen them walk into a kitchen during Christmas time and stop dead in their tracks? Have you ever seen a hand move involuntarily to their chests or to their mouths? You are witnessing a memory wave hitting the iceberg of consciousness. The little has just come to the surface of its being, and all it has to do is make that split decision to either let the little out or force everything back down inside. By the time you become a Biggle, you've collected a good many memories. Believe it or not, that actually happens to be one of the perks of becoming older. You see, people aged 20 to 24 are sad for an average of 3.4 days per month, as opposed to just 2.3 days for people aged 65 to 74. If you ask me, the happiness factor has to do with being able to pull up a happy memory when it's most needed. Just because Biggles sometimes make the decision to force everything back down inside doesn't mean they don't earnestly wish to connect with that little, or with the true meaning of Christmas for that matter. It's just that surrendering to the emotional release of that experience has become something foreign to them, something to be avoided because they fear a loss of control. Biggles like to feel they are in control. They want to feel in control of their lives, their things, their destinies, their emotions, their world, everything. Perhaps it's because when they were littles, they got the impression that this is what Biggles do. After all, littles are controlled by Biggles almost all of the time, so it's only natural that they relate Biggleness to an ability to always be in control. On the other hand, perhaps Biggles wants so much to be in control because as they grow older, they begin to realize how little control they actually do have, or ever have had, and they panic. I'm only an elf, so I really can't say for sure. These are merely observations, you understand. Humans, by nature, do like to share things. Most of all, they love to share laughter. There's nothing so wonderful as seeing several thousand people laughing together. A circus, a comedy in a theater, it doesn't matter where or what. People will sit next to total strangers and share the gift of laughter with them. Absolutely marvelous. Public speakers always try to relax their audiences by telling a joke. Our greatest role models have always been the ones who taught us that it's okay to laugh at ourselves. Romantic imaginings have always created heroes who laughed in the face of danger. In real life, that trait usually demonstrates a severe lack of common sense. The bottom line here is that laughter is a common bond that binds us all together on this planet. But so is sadness. If we are bound by laughter, we are equally bound by our tears. But tears are not what people prefer to share with each other, given the choice. And that's understandable. I'm certainly not recommending that everyone walk around sobbing on each other's shoulders all the time. Maybe just some of the time. When we channel it properly, emotional release is quite healing. After all, crying is one of the first ways humans learn to communicate with the world. A hungry baby can't tell you it's hungry. The baby cries. If nothing else, someone crying will certainly get in your attention. Crying is a fundamental mode of expression and emotional release. Tears, like laughter, can be some of the best medicine we ever take. So what do crying, bad shrimp, laughter, memories, and childhood have to do with Christmas morning? Sometimes more than we realize. As much as we look forward to the holiday season, as much as we joyfully anticipate the togetherness of family and friends, as much as we need the experience of laughter shared, as much as all of this, we also need to go through a bit of healthy Christmas morning. What is Christmas really all about? Be careful not to repeat a memorized answer or go for the conditioned knee-jerk response here. It's time for you to give the question some very serious thought. Because as long as you allow someone else to define it for you, the chances of you ever knowing the joys of personal fulfillment remain slim. It's like the story of the man who searched for happiness all his life and never found it. On his deathbed, someone asked him what happiness was. The man thought about it for a moment, smiled, sighed, and died. In that split second, he realized it after all. For him, perhaps happiness was simply defining the source of his search, something he had never stopped to do. We got a generation of people out there searching for something, and most of them don't even know what that something is. Christmas became a national holiday in America on June 26, 1870. You've been celebrating it ever since. So we're back to the original question. What is Christmas really all about? Okay, here goes. Christmas is about meeting needs. Works for me. How about you? Spiritual needs, emotional needs, physical needs, religious needs, mental needs, you name it. There are some things in life that all human beings need and require. There are some things in life that only certain individuals need. Or perhaps we all need the same thing, only in different quantities. This need we all harbor is obviously with us all year long, but it is most particularly felt during the holiday season. This is because, aside from everything else, all of us need some bit of magic in our lives. And of all other times during the entire year, Christmas provides us with the opportunity. Let me quickly identify what I mean when I refer to a magical Christmas. And I can best do that by simply pointing out one of the things I don't mean. I don't mean Christmas is magical in the sense that we just go to bed on Christmas Eve and everything gets done for us. That isn't magic. It's laziness. And just in case any of you believe that the story of the shoemaker and the elves is an exception to the rule, go back and reread it. The old shoemaker and his wife did their fair share of work in the scheme of things. Happiness isn't just handed to you on a silver platter, not even in a fairy tale. Santa Claus is nearer than anyone else realizes, but you do have to go and meet him. You also have to go and meet your own needs and other aspects of your life on this planet. And remember that it can't truly be called a voyage until you've lost sight of the shore. There is a lot of tradition connected to the celebration of this very special holiday, and family is a great part of it all. When we used to think of an average family, we knew that meant a father, a mother, and two children. These were the same families that went over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house for the holidays. This memory of the past is the strongest emotional connection many people have to Christmas, and a great deal of human mourning is taking place because of changes in the world's traditional concept of family structure. Today, 1 in 4 American children grow up in a single-parent family. Census numbers from 1990 show that more than 3 million grandparents are raising their children's children. Parents now regularly separate, divorce, and remarry, sometimes more than once. The traditional family has been transformed into the contemporary family, and we all need to be a bit more aware of that fact. Everyone prepares for Christmas, and this preparation has, over a period of time, taken on the trappings of ceremony. Ceremony is a very important part of human existence, but by no means is it the heart or center of it all. Technique is important to art in the same respect. So important, in fact, that technique is often mistaken for art. So the ceremony of Christmas is often mistaken for Christmas itself. For that matter, the ceremony of living is often mistaken for life. The truth is that a contemporary society is always going to have a few difficulties with its traditional ceremonies. That is why a certain amount of spiritual preparation, alignment, is also an ongoing need. Some of this Christmas preparation is a conscious effort on your part. You make a conscious effort to drag the same decorations down from the attic year after year. You make a conscious effort to go out and buy a tree. You make a conscious effort to say to yourself, "This year, I'm going to get it all done on time for once in my life." You are aware of your actions and make conscious efforts on behalf of your own personal preparation for this special time of year. But it is important to understand that some of your preparation is also subconscious. You do it without thinking about it at all. You hear Christmas music, and immediately something happens. You experience a conditioned, knee-jerk reaction while your automatic pilot light flickers on. You place the same ornaments on the same kind of tree each year. The same Christmas decorations go in their traditional places throughout your home. If you've always gone to midnight mass, you'll make every effort to continue that habit. You may even have traditional gifts that are on your shopping list each and every year for the same people. Who said Dad should always get a necktie? You approach the entire holiday season by slipping into a carefully controlled and manipulated glide path that you hope will ultimately land you under the tree on Christmas morning. Is there any wonder that so many are so often disappointed? Time sets a great example. It moves forward, and so should we. The past is a great place to visit, but you wouldn't really want to live there. It's just that, especially during the holidays, people tend to cling to some expectation of having to redo things as they have always been done, or perhaps at least they try to finally get it right for once. This can lead to more than a little frustration and anxiety, when what you think is supposed to happen doesn't happen. That's because you've confused the celebration of Christmas with the reincarnation of the past. Right away, you've set tremendous limitations on the amount of joy you will ever be able to experience. Recycled joy may be better than no joy at all, but not by much. Since Christmas is also a time for family, it also stands to reason that Christmas is a time for trying to meet their needs as well as yours. Now, there you are, trying to come to terms with what your own personal needs are, and the house is filling up with noisy relatives. Or is it? Perhaps some thought ought to be given to what it now means to be part of a contemporary family. You also need to understand that the term contemporary doesn't mean that families are, out of modern necessity, non-traditional. This isn't the case at all. But we do live in the moment. We live and breathe in the now. We are all, therefore, contemporary. And in the truest sense, we all also belong to one family. I don't think I could tell you how many elves live and work at the North Pole. I've lost count. What I can tell you is that each and every elf who lives at the North Pole is part of one gigantic, loving, and extended family. So perhaps it's time for all of us to try to be a little more sensitive to the makeup and needs of the families to which we belong. It's also important for you to understand that you have yesterday families, as well as today families. And while you should always remember and cherish what your yesterday family was, you also need to see it as what it has become. Not myth, not memory, not something created in a lovely Frank Capra film. We need to see it, really see it, as it is. You need to understand that when you mourn the past, you are sometimes merely mourning the time you've lost to your own spiritual adolescence. There is nothing intrinsically wrong with this, so long as you understand that you have also, hopefully, moved beyond what you once were. You've been around long enough to have identified a few of your needs. You've also learned that part of living is having to eventually get about the business of meeting the needs you've identified. You humans have all sorts of cognitive biases that make it easy to forget the good things, or you simply let the bad things overshadow them. The truth is that you actually have to work to keep them from disappearing from your memory altogether. One of the quickest, easiest ways to do that is to set a specific time to remember. How hard could that be? Turn off the television set, gather the family around the hearth, and share memories of Christmas. It might well be the most meaningful holiday gift you've ever given or received. The gift, of course, is always to the giver. The ancient Romans gave themselves a holiday that served as a sort of catalyst for all of this. It was called Juvenalia, the festival of childhood and youth. It was a time for celebrating what you once were, as a way of finding deeper meaning and contentment with what you had become. This holiday was always begun on the first day of January. What a splendid way to start the new year. I'll tell you something I've noticed about you humans. It has to do with one particular, private little Christmas Eve ceremony many of you allow yourselves. Know what it is? I'm amazed at the number of you who steal yourself a bit of private time and find a reason to go outside on Christmas Eve. Some of you simply step out onto the doorstep in order to take a deep breath of night air. Some of you take a walk around the block. Some go to church or to visit friends. The thing is, you all seem to find your own personal reasons for going outside. There's something so incredibly special about that one night. It's in the air, almost tangible, something profoundly beautiful and calming to the soul. Christmas Eve has had that effect on many people over the years. In 1865, for example, an Episcopal rector named Phillips Brooks was traveling through the Holy Land. He had arranged his schedule so that he would be in Bethlehem on Christmas Eve. When evening fell, at the end of that very special day, he rode on horseback to a hill overlooking the town. There he spent most of the night gazing down on the sacred beauty before him. Then, almost without thinking, he pulled paper and pencil from his coat pocket. Wanting, somehow, to capture what he was seeing and feeling, he began to jot down a few lines of poetry. 3 years later, the young clergyman gave the 5 verses of his poem to Lewis Redner, his organist and Sunday school superintendent. Brooks asked his friend if he might consider setting the poem to music. Redner shook his head in quiet desperation. It was December once again, and his obligations as organist at the Church of the Advent and Holy Trinity in Philadelphia were considerable. He didn't know how he'd possibly find the time or inspiration, at least not with everything else there was to do. Still, he told Brooks he would try. For a week, Redner struggled with the task, but nothing seemed to satisfy him. Nothing seemed to do the poetry justice. Something was missing, and Redner knew it. He finally went to bed on Christmas Eve, still disappointed in himself for not being able to think of a melody, a few satisfactory notes. Later that night, he awoke from a deep sleep and turned to gaze out of his window at the beautiful star-filled sky, a sky very much like the sky his friend had seen over Bethlehem. In that moment, the music came to him. It literally poured from his heart and soul onto the manuscript paper, finished and complete. In the years to come, Redner would always refer to the tune as his very own gift from heaven. It was a bequest he and Phillips Brooks shared with the rest of the world, a gift that continues to bring that same world closer together. Today we still know the poetry and music as an endearing Christmas song titled, O Little Town of Bethlehem. And how about the most famous Christmas carol of all, Silent Night? It wasn't just written about Christmas Eve. It was written on a Christmas Eve. It was written in the Austrian village of Oberndorf on Christmas Eve 1818. But that's another story. The truth is that we all find our own juvenilias eventually, and there is always something bittersweet in each of them. One important juvenilia in all of our lives is the permission we give ourselves to grieve. You do need to occasionally remind yourself that it's okay to miss loved ones, to miss your youth, to miss what was, to miss all those things that make humans human. It is allowed. You need to know that it's perfectly all right to hear Christmas music and be moved to tears. It's all right to watch your littles performing in a school's pageant and be moved to tears. It's all right to be together with old friends during the holidays and be moved to tears. It's all right to walk into a kitchen, inhale those wonderful smells, and be moved to tears. It's all right to meet your own needs where all of this is concerned. It is allowed. Christmas morning has as much a place in your celebration as any other emotion you're going to experience during the entire holiday season. In fact, a little healthy Christmas morning will actually enable you to add more depth to the rest of your feelings. All you're doing is simply blowing a little carbon out of the pipes. You're cleaning out your emotional insides in preparation for being able to truly celebrate the holiday season. You're making more room for joy. And that's not a bad recipe for Christmas at all. And once you've gone there, grieved a little, given vent to some honest mourning, taken care of a little spiritual house cleaning, you can better separate yourself from the inevitable holiday depression and sadness. Just remember, take the you out of the word mourning, and what you have is a new day. That's when you finally begin to understand what a Merry Christmas is really all about.
And this brings us to the end of the third hour of Ira David Wood III's Confessions of an Elf. The fourth hour will begin with about a 7-minute break. So if you have to go away, go away. Otherwise, sit back and listen up. Robin Bullock's got some more music for us.